Well, I think they should do a gut check about their economic policies, because you're absolutely right. The plurality top election issue was with the economy, and specifically inflation. It wasn't fear of losing jobs, which is unemployment rates relatively low. It's inflation, which is one of the most damaging events that could ever happen to an incumbent administration, not just in the United States, but around the world. Lots of governing parties across Europe, other places, they've lost power after the bout of inflation that followed the COVID-19 pandemic. The difference between inflation and unemployment is that even in high levels of unemployment, 10% unemployment, 12% unemployment, the vast majority of people have jobs. But inflation affects everybody. It affects them differently. Lower income people get hurt more by inflation typically than higher income people. But it's a cancer that eats away at the economic body. And so it's just a disaster. And when you look at the numbers, you can see that. This is why I would say, for example, I would not go as far as to suggest that these election results confer some sort of overwhelming mandate on Trump or MAGA world or anything like that. They weren't the main issues. The main issue was not Biden. It was not Harris. And let me fortify this point with some evidence. If you look at the two different exit polls, actually asking actual voters what they were thinking about, both of them show the following dynamic. Somewhere between 40, 45, somewhere in that range percent of American voters who turned out this year said they had a favorable view of Kamala Harris, maybe personally or maybe just on policy, and they voted for her almost entirely. A somewhat smaller number, 42, 43, something like that, said they had a favorable view of Trump. In fact, Trump still is less popular than Kamala Harris. So how did he win?
Which is crazy to me. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing, though. Here's how he won. The people who said they disliked both of them went for Trump overwhelming. Like two-thirds or more of that group went for Trump, even though they don't like him very much. Now, you can't, I think, convert that into everybody loves the president-elect. They absolutely favored him and his stated economic goals and policies over those of the administration they held responsible for inflation. Now, there's other things going on in the election, as you point out. For voters who said that abortion was the number one issue, they went primarily for Harris. People who said immigration was the number one issue, they went primarily for Trump. But very few people said anything about foreign policy, about the environment, about transgender rights. Not a very high percentage identified that as a top voting issue. So those are issues that people care about. I'm not trying to discount that. But if you're trying to figure out why Trump won and most Republican candidates won, or why Harris, more importantly, why Harris lost and most Democrats in the competitive races lost, you will find that it is overwhelmingly about inflation. The voters were angry about it, even though it has subsided. But of course, it hasn't reversed. Those price increases are not going to be reversed. They were very angry about it. And they said, well, we had Trump and inflation wasn't there. And we've had Biden and inflation was there. Let's go back to Trump.
John, I met you because I went through the E.A. Morris program many, many years ago. And I have credited that program with fundamentally changing my life and the people that I had an opportunity to meet, the lessons and things that I had an opportunity to learn. I would say that in that program, you all taught me the definition of leadership. You sort of ruined me because now in the real world, people don't see leadership and character the same way that you taught me in the E.A. Morris program. What do we do, John? Because I'm concerned about what does this mean for future elections, not only on the Republican side, but on the Democratic side. It does feel like character and leadership and those kind of qualities are becoming less and less important.
It does feel that way. There is certainly evidence for that at the presidential level. But I would suggest that when you go down the ballot to other offices, and when you think about non-electoral leaders, people who are leaders of institutions, I think a lot of Americans, a lot of North Carolinians still care a lot about the character of those kinds of leaders, people who lead organizations, people who lead companies, people who lead firms, people who lead universities, people who lead hospitals, you know, other large institutions, schools in our society. Leadership is still relevant. And we saw that in the gubernatorial race in North Carolina. I think in a way the presidency has become the exception that unfortunately may not prove the rule, but may have a corrosive effect over time. The majority of the people who voted, or at least a plurality of the people who voted, chose Donald Trump. Many of them believe he is a great leader. But if it had only been those who thought he was a great leader who voted for Trump, he would have lost. He would have lost by a significant margin. He got additional votes from people who do not think he is a particularly aspirational or praiseworthy leader. They question his character or his leadership ability, but they just thought his policies would be better for them, or that Kamala Harris's leadership qualities were lacking, or something like that. So I totally take your point. I feel a little guilty teaching people that character matters, but actually I don't, because character does matter, and it was Will Allen in the end, and we will see what happens over the next several years.
I think you're correct, and I'm trying to remind people that I you know, the pendulum always swings. The law of rhythm compensates for all these movements, and I think the pendulum will continue to swing. You know, this was really fascinating to me watching the race. Harris proposed tax credits for small business owners, new home buyers. She wanted to work with the real estate development community to boost the housing stock. Trump, on the other hand, proposed spending $300 billion on finishing his border wall, 200% tariffs, and no taxes on tips for the service industry. Now, if you blindfolded me and didn't tell me the year, I would think that the Democratic policies were the Republican policies and the Republican policies were the Democratic policies. And maybe I've just now lived long enough to see the inversion happen, but help me and my audience understand what's going on between these two parties, because it seems like the underlying voter base is really starting to shift.
It has shifted somewhat. The stated philosophies of the parties, go beyond the presidential race, you look at lots of other candidates running for Congress, legislature, and things like that, they still are fairly conventional Republican and Democratic stances. You are, however, correct that in the presidential race, things got scrambled a bit. But I would again suggest that lots of voters, if you ask them which presidential candidate was going to raise your taxes and which presidential candidate was going to lower your taxes, they would have said Harris in the first case and Trump in the second case. According to what the candidates themselves have said, that may not be the correct conclusion. You know, there might be some people who might have had a slight decrease in their income taxes under the Trump rewrite starting in 2025 with the tax code, but maybe tariffs will be up and they'll have a net tax increase and they wouldn't know that. Mm. And there may be people who thought that Harris was going to raise their taxes, but again, according to her stated policies, they would have actually received tax relief. The truth is that not only were not a lot of these details widely understood or widely shared, but I think people are properly skeptical of claims. For example, I know Republican voters who understand that tariffs are tax increases. And when I ask them, well, yeah, but you're voting for Trump, said, oh, he's not really going to do it. Because, of course, Republicans wouldn't raise taxes. And similarly, I knew folks who were going to run, who were going to vote the other way, and told that Kamala Harris had promised various tax decreases and tax incentives, said, I don't think she'll actually do that. So there is a built up, just like on foreign policy, there is a built up set of assumptions that people have about D's and R's that may not necessarily comport with a particular race, particular policies that, for example, Harris and Trump articulated, but it still matter.
Yeah, I recently wrote about Trump's tariff proposals and the impact that it could have here in North Carolina. For my audience, that's in the Carolina Journal. Go to carolinajournal.com. And you can read that and much other commentary that I provided during the election cycle. But these tariffs will hurt. They will specifically harm us right here in North Carolina. And when Trump raised tariffs before, it's surprising to me that people believe he won't do it, because he's already done it before. He did it when he was in office the first time.
They argue that it's all a negotiating.
And it actually had a negative impact on agriculture and trade right here in North Carolina. So I think it's very plausible that it could happen again. When you're talking to Republicans or just even talking to the general voter, what are you hearing is the most important issues right here in our backyard?
Well, every conversation continues to line up with what we're seeing in the polls as well. So it's really that the polls are indicative of what we're hearing in the pulse on the electorate here in North Carolina. It continues to be the economy and inflation, and then the southern border and the crime that's coming across it, the drugs that are coming across it, especially fentanyl, and the devastating impacts that both of those issues are having on our citizens across North Carolina and across the country. As you look at the economy, it was Joe Biden on day one that canceled the Keystone Pipeline, pursued Green New Deals on his energy policies, which then drove up energy costs, drove up then cost of everything. So when you're going to the grocery store, you're paying more. You're paying more for every household goods and services. The average family of four is paying more than $1,000 a month for the same goods and services that they were paying for 4 years ago. And then when you again look at just the crisis with the border, people are concerned about the public safety. And so those two issues continue to be critical on decisions that were made by President Biden. Day one, they're having a devastating impact on our communities. And then you follow that up with education, especially here at a statewide or a local level. Families are concerned about making sure their children have a high quality education and access to it. And Democrats continue to want to throw money to a failing system while Republicans are coming to the table with creative means to be able to give school choice to families and especially students.
You know, you talk about the 10 million people that have already come across the border. Some people, I don't know if we really have a good idea of what that number is. I mean, I've heard 10 million, I've heard 20 million, I've heard a lot of different numbers, but I Yep. guess we can, yeah, I think we can all agree that it's a big number and it's a lot of people. And, you know, for my audience that a lot of times hear these debates about immigration, you know, obviously North Carolina is not at the southern border. People mistakenly think that, you know, we can't be affected by the immigration issue. But I feel like what's occurred is, as you've had more and more people come into the country, they're not all staying in Texas and New Mexico and California. I mean, they're dispersing throughout the entire country. And right now, North Carolina happens to be one, I believe, like the third fastest growing state. And we believe that the illegal immigration issue is a part of it as well. You know, that dovetails into my question, Jason. I mean, we're seeing a lot of people show up here in North Carolina. They're coming from a lot of different places. They are bringing their ideology. They are bringing their politics. They're bringing their vision, which might differ from what traditional North Carolina politics has looked like over the last several decades or however long. You know, how are the changing demographics in North Carolina influencing the strategies and priorities of the North Carolina Republican Party?
Sure. So much as you're looking at kind of the growth, it's where is it? Who is it? And so as you look, especially in our large metro regions, whether it's the Triangle, the Triad, or in the Charlotte region, you've got individuals coming for really a lot of business opportunities, jobs, and those opportunities that come with it. And then you look along our coast, our beautiful coast, which is continuing to invite a lot of retirees. And so you end up with a different dynamic and different ideological perspectives that the individuals are bringing in. So as we look at the Triangle, the Triad, Charlotte, you have a growing number of individuals who continue to not identify with a political party. They're registering unaffiliated. Doesn't mean that they don't have an ideological perspective. They're going to fall somewhere along that ideological perspective from liberal to conservative. And so we end up spending more time and effort trying to understand who these individuals are, where are they, what is the message that's going to resonate with them? Where are they on that political ideological perspective? And being able to then have that outreach, have those conversations with them, engage with them where they're at, and to be able to identify, you know, those individuals that we believe would continue to support Republican policies that have been so effective here in North Carolina, especially when you look at the Republican legislature for more than a decade now, continuing to drive down the tax burden upon both businesses and individuals, which has created such great economic growth and opportunities across our state, which as we continue to see for the past 2 years, CNBC recognizing North Carolina as a great place to do business. And that's a direct result of the economic policies that have been put in place by the Republican legislature.
Let's look long term and further down the road in terms of the party itself. Do you personally, I mean, you've been around a while, you've seen a lot, seen even more than me. I mean, you've been an insider. Do you see any danger in this shift away from traditional conservatism to more of a populist movement?
What I would say is you continue to see trend lines year to year, cycle to cycle. And so it's the ever evolving nature of our society and our political parties best suit themselves to where they see society going and following the will of the people. And that's where I put my confidence and trust in. That's where the political parties and the candidates especially make sure that they have a sense of where society is going, where are our values, and aligning them to that, as well as then making sure to continue to stand up for the party platform and those real traditional values that the Republican Party continues to stand up for. Again, lower taxes, the sanctity of life, and making sure that everybody has the opportunity to pursue the American dream and do so without impunity of the government. We want to make sure we have a lower government involvement in our lives. We want to make sure that we are paying lower taxes. But being able to have a government that's able to provide the basic necessities to our society and do so in a manner that's responsible.
You know, I go to a lot of town halls. I talk to a lot of candidates. I'm friends with many different elected officials. You know, I rarely, at least in this particular cycle, I rarely hear a lot of these people talk about specific issues to North Carolina. And I, you know, North Carolina is the best state to do business in 3 years in a row. We've had, you know, probably over 20,000 private sector jobs announced in the last several years. Mm-hmm. We are growing tremendously. I think we have one of the best locations on the East Coast. We've got great infrastructure, great colleges. We still have some issues we need to address. But I hear people talking more about these national issues than they do the state issues. Talk a little bit about the risk and danger there of allowing a complete, you know, a complete projection of national politics or superimposing national politics on what we do here in North Carolina.
Yeah, and this is where I give you a lot of credit as well, Algernon, making sure to inform really everyone of what's going on. We've seen really a decrease in quality media. And I think as you continue to see the media decrease locally, whether that's, you know, especially the local papers and the quality journalism and being able to talk about those local issues. So then what you're left with is really television, especially on the national side, your cable news. And so everybody's continuing to get their news feeds either there, or if you're of a younger generation, it's from whatever mobile app that you're focusing on. And that continues to really be the thing that is we're looking in the future. Where are those sources of information that people are looking at? Where are they getting their information? And so that's where, again, I applaud you on being able to put out high quality information to inform people, giving them an opportunity and candidates an opportunity to talk about those issues and try and cut through the clutter, especially at the national level, where that's where all the attention ends up being drawn. We have great candidates at the local level across our state that are running for city council, county commissioners, sheriff races that are just so important at those local levels. And again, we talk about it at the you know, at our level where we're talking about, you know, those local races are the things that are going to be the most impactful on you. Those are the ones that set the budgets. Those are the ones that set the tax rates. Those are the ones that are determining, hey, what does funding look like for our schools? What does funding look like for our teachers? You know, that's not determined at the national level. Those are made at the most local level at your county commissions and school boards, your city council. And so that's where, again, it's frustrating to see across our state and nationally, really the decrease of good quality journalism and information to be able to get out there and have these types of forums to be able to talk about local issues and inform people.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I'm and my audience knows, I mean, if you listen to me, I've been so consistent with this, but if you are truly concerned about public safety, if you're concerned about jobs, housing, quality of life issues, I mean, you should definitely be paying closer attention to your city council race than you are the congressional race. And I do think Congress and everything they do at a federal level is critically important, but they just don't have the impact on your day-to-day life like your mayor and your county commissioner and your school board members do. So I think you're spot on. Thank you for the compliment about what we're trying to do here with the show. And I will tell you, there was a poll that came out this year that said 40% of people from 18 to 30 receive their news from TikTok. And that's frightening. I mean, and these people, they get to show up every first Tuesday in November and vote for somebody. I mean, it's frightening. It's scary. What information you may be using to base your decision making off of when your source for that information is a social media platform. I mean, it's really frightening. I've been around the party for a long time. I jokingly say this, but it's true. I cast my first Republican vote in fifth grade in a straw poll for George Bush. And I was 10 years old. I was in the fifth grade. I didn't know anything about parties, but for whatever reason, the Republican Party felt right to me. And then when I became a door-to-door salesman coming out of college, I would ride around and listen to Rush Limbaugh all the time and conservative radio. And that's really where I started to sharpen some of my skills around conservatism. Here's my question. There was a period, Jason, where Republicans talked about the economy more. We had more conversations about debt. We talked about, fiscal austerity. We had a lot more conversations about substantive policies. And it just feels like to me in the last 4 to 8 years, we've sort of migrated away from that. You're hard pressed to find a Republican to even mention what's going on with the national debt right now. Explain that to me. How have we shifted away from some of those public policy issues? And then how do we bring those back central to a lot of the conversations that we're having?
It's this right here. It's these ongoing conversations. It's having those conversations with the elected officials and candidates and really driving home the importance of the national debt. Making sure, again, you go back to 90, what was that, 94, the last time that Congress had a balanced budget and being able to then drive down, again, driven by Republican majorities in the House and making sure that they were then forcing those issues to be able to bring sanity to our budgeting process. And so I think, for many of us, you look at the national debt and it just becomes this number that doesn't even feel real. But there are real consequences behind that, and especially making sure those that hold a lot of our debt, aren't going to hold that where it becomes a real national security issue more than it probably is today. And so really it's engaging with our candidates, engaging with our elected officials to have those conversations about bringing sanity to our budgeting process, and especially making sure that we can curtail that. And it's really also going to be a lot of hard conversations, because when you're looking at the budget process, if we're going to have a real impact on that, there's going to have to be some real difficult decisions on that.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to look more structurally at what we're doing, which means we're probably going to have to touch some mandatory spending programs that I know have become favorite programs for a lot of people. But in order for us to implement a true fiscal austerity plan, it's really going to require that. And I'm counting on you, Jason, and all your colleagues to continue to remind Republican candidates and Republican elected officials that we do need to have these conversations. We do need to talk about, $30+ trillion in national debt, and probably closer to 70 trillion if you take in all the unfunded liabilities associated with Social Security. That's a mind-boggling number. And for my audience that's out there listening to this conversation, I want to remind you, in case you have forgotten, probably over 50% of the federal debt is held by you. It's held by treasury bonds that are in your pension plans, that are in your 401ks, that are in your IRAs. You are one of the largest lenders to this country. And I question sometimes if this country could continue to get approved for a loan if they had to go through the process that we have to go through as ordinary citizens. So it is something that we need to take.
The real dynamic that's of interest to me is how quickly North Carolina is changing from a voter standpoint. We continue to grow as a state at a pace of about 100,000, 120,000 new residents every year. A significant portion of that in-migration comes to the major metropolitan areas. If you look at the data from the last census of 2020, half of the in-migration into the state of North Carolina ended up with increased population in both Wake and Mecklenburg County. So the two biggest counties in the state were absorbing half of all of the in-migration. So continuing to build this incredible urbanization in North Carolina, not something we have a history of. We were not a state of big cities for much of the 20th century. In fact, I always remind people in the census of 1900, the biggest city in North Carolina was Wilmington, as port cities often were in Atlantic seaboard states. And so this has changed our politics in a significant way, not just that there are more people here and people from other parts of the country, and they bring somewhat their political dispositions with them and then accommodate that as a voter in North Carolina, but still principally that disposition is born out of wherever it is they're from. But the increased populational density in the state is also having an impact. If you go back to the last presidential election in 2020, there's some body of academic research that the population density of about 500 people per square mile starts to produce a more predictable Democratic candidate performance. And so in congressional districts where the overall population density is 500 or more people per square mile, far more likely to elect a Democrat. In the counties that Donald Trump won in North Carolina in 2020, the average population density was only about 150 people per square mile, where the average for Joe Biden was slightly over 450 people per square mile. So we see that urbanization and population density now being a factor in North Carolina politics. And it's just different for us. It's a different thing. We're also seeing an incredible diversification of the population of registered voters in the state. Now, about 4% of the state's registered voters are Hispanic, but 10% of the state's population is. And so over the next decade or so, we will see an increasing percentage of Hispanic voters in the state, kids that were born in North Carolina. Their parents may not have been here with documentation. They were born here. They were raised as North Carolinians and will have voting rights when they turn 18. That's a very different dynamic from a voting standpoint than North Carolina has a history with as well. A significant portion of the voting population being second generation Americans. And so we also see an increase in the number of Asian voters, principally people from the country of India. Indian Americans are now representing a significant portion of the electorate as well. And so that increased density population and urbanization and diversification has making us a very different state. So in some ways, the predictive models that we might look to in terms of what's going to happen in North Carolina are less and less reliable because of these changes taking place. We may, over the next several presidential election cycles, really have to learn as we go along, in part because those dynamics are so different than what North Carolina has been like for much of the preceding 100 years.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.